Hello, everyone. This should be my last episode. I'm just gonna let the introduction play out. Hope you enjoy. Hello, future doctors. You're tuning into Spoonful of Sugar, the podcast made for and by medical students, where we break down complex topics into bite-sized pieces for your success. I'm your host, Bilal Rana, a third year at Western U, and today we're doing a high-yield, rapid review of psychiatry. How this will work is I'll be using other episodes and some other material as reference to do a high-yield review of pretty much all the topics that are important for the purposes of USMLE Step 1 or COMLEX. We will be discussing the following topics in the following order. The first one will be psychoactive drugs, intoxication, and withdrawal. We'll do a general overview of the different types of drugs, and we'll spend a little bit more time talking about opioids and benzodiazepines, since the board examiners would like you to know more about these in detail. Then we'll be talking about mood disorders, including their pharmacology. Then we'll be talking about schizophrenia and antipsychotics. We'll then wrap up with discussions about personality disorders, defense mechanisms, and different forms of psychotherapy. And although this is a rapid review of psychiatry, we will still be maintaining our Q&A format. And how that works, in case you are new to Spoonful of Sugar, is that I'll be asking questions periodically. I'll leave a pause for a few seconds to let you answer the question. Don't worry if you get these wrong the first, second, or even third time. The purposes of this is for you to review and understand. Not everybody gets it right the first time. I know I didn't. It's okay if you don't. This is the time to make the mistakes. This is the time to learn. So to begin, let's first talk about psychoactive drugs, what happens when you're intoxicated on them, and what happens when you withdraw from them. Let's begin our discussion with stimulants. Can you name some common stimulants you'll need to know for the purposes of board examinations? So amphetamines, cocaine, nicotine, and caffeine. Caffeine is also a stimulant that you may need to know. The general premise of these, you don't really need to get too specific, is they work on blocking the reuptake or encouraging neurotransmitter release. Okay? Intoxication symptoms. What would happen if you're intoxicated on these stimulants? Generally, you would expect to see elevated mood, decreased appetite, psychomotor agitation, insomnia, cardiac arrhythmias, or on a lesser note, tachycardia, as well as anxiety. If these signs and symptoms are observed, how would you treat them? Depends on the stimulant of use, of course. If it's a heavier stimulant, like cocaine or amphetamines, benzodiazepines are your best friend. Though if it's something like caffeine, you're usually looking at symptomatic management. Now what about withdrawal from stimulants? What would you expect to see? Yeah, kind of a crash. If stimulants are to bring you up, then withdrawal is going to do the exact opposite. You can look at symptoms of depression, fatigue, anxiety, difficulty concentrating, and even restlessness. One more thing about stimulants, I did mention nicotine as one of them. And one of the things that you'll need to know about nicotine is the treatment for nicotine cessation. Can you think of some pharmacological interventions for this? So there's three that you're going to want to know. One of them is the obvious, you know, nicotine patches, gums, lozenges. I don't normally see this on board exams. The other two are more high yield. The first of these is varenicline. Do you know the mechanism of action for this? So you might remember from the sketchy that varenicline is a cholinergic. If we were to be more specific, it specifically acts on nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. So the nicotinic receptors in question are in fact cholinergic receptors, hence why you probably saw that in the sketchy. And the other one is actually an antidepressant. Do you know which one I'm referring to? That would be bupropion, which has been shown to help with nicotine cessation. You remember the mechanism of action for bupropion? Not as high yield, but I figured I'd just mention it anyway. It's a norepinephrine and dopamine reuptake inhibitor. So it's an NDRI. Not that you have to know the abbreviation, just thought I'd mention it. The next category of psychoactive drugs we're going to talk about are technically also stimulants, but in a different way. These are hallucinogens. Can you think of some examples here? So some hallucinogens would include LSD, marijuana, MDMA, and PCP. Again, PCP in particular is very, very stimulating, so I can understand why stimulants and hallucinogens, they can kind of be one and the same, but they're also a little bit different because of the symptoms. What kind of symptoms would you expect? A distortion of perception, depersonalization, psychosis, paranoia, panic attacks. Pretty serious stuff. I want to talk a little bit about PCP. This one is mega stimulatory, as I mentioned earlier. Some of the key findings that you're going to see, and this is how it's going to be presented to you. It's usually going to be a patient who is severely belligerent, severely agitated to the point where it takes multiple people to hold them down. Another key finding that they may share with you in a question stem is nystagmus. This could either be vertical or horizontal nystagmus, but generally speaking, if you see a patient who's severely agitated and has nystagmus, very likely the answer is going to be PCP intoxication. Now, of course, this one is going to be a little bit different from LSD, which is more notorious for its visual hallucinations and a feature called synesthesias, which is when you see sound as color. And then marijuana has some interesting intoxication symptoms. I mean, you have your euphoria, your anxiety, the basic stuff, but it kind of slows you down. So your perception of time is slowed. You have impaired judgment. Key things you're going to want to know. They have increased appetite. They might even have red eyes. So all in all, it's pretty distinct from the other hallucinogens. Now, withdrawal from all these, if hallucinogens are a variant of stimulants, then you could probably guess that withdrawal would cause the opposite. Depression, anxiety, irritability, insomnia, etc., etc. Okay, now we're going to move on to depressants. This is the more high-yield portion of the substance abuses that you'll need to know. So we're going to be talking about opioids, barbiturates, benzodiazepines, and alcohol. I first want to start about opioids. So first off, let's look at the mechanism. What receptor do they act on? So they act on a variety of receptors. It's usually the mu, delta, or kappa receptors. Do you need to know the difference between them? Maybe. Is it high yield? Not really, so I'm not going to talk about that here. And what are they used for? What are the primary use of opioids? Pain control, right. So opioids act in the brain and the spinal cord, and they modulate the pain transmission. Now, other than the receptors that they bind to, how do they actually work? Opioids work by closing calcium channels and opening potassium channels. And what are the symptoms that you would expect in the setting of opioid intoxication? So it can start with, you know, central nervous system and respiratory depression. You can also expect to see constricted pupils, a decreased gag reflex, seizures, and even constipation. What you'll definitely want to know for the purposes of board examinations are the different types of opioids. So let's first talk about the partial agonists. Can you name some? Well, there's only one that you'll really need to know, and that's buprenorphine. A pretty wonderful drug, if I might say. And what is this primarily used for? So buprenorphine is used in the management of opioid addiction. There is a specific thing that you're going to need to know about this regarding its pharmacology. Do you know what I'm referring to? It's the ceiling effect. So this is pretty high yield. Well, let me explain this real quick. What buprenorphine is going to do is it's going to tag all the opioid receptors, just as any other opioid will. But it only does so partially, meaning that if all the receptors are occupied partially, then there is a maximum limit on how strong the effects actually are. So if you were to compare buprenorphine to a full agonist and you were to overdose on both of them, the likelihood that you're going to experience serious symptoms from buprenorphine is going to be a lot less because it's only partially activating these receptors. So knowing this fact, you can potentially see why buprenorphine is a really amazing drug for management of opioid addiction. So those are the partial agonists, or the one partial agonist. Can you name some full agonists? So this is the stronger stuff that you may have been familiar with, morphine and fentanyl. And what are these used for? primarily for the management of pain. And there's one more full agonist that you want to know. Can you think of what that is? That would be methadone. And what is methadone primarily used for? So this is primarily used for the management of opioid addiction, just like buprenorphine. The difference is it's a lot stronger. And how you decide between buprenorphine or methadone is usually due to the severity of the addiction, but that is something that is way, 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 way beyond the scope of step one, so don't worry about that. And then you'll also want to know about the opioid antagonists. There are two that I am thinking of. Can you think of those? So we have naloxone and naltrexone. What is naloxone used for? It's used for opioid overdoses. There is a caveat to this, however, and you may need to know this for step one. It does have an extremely short half-life, so the naloxone can wear away after using it, and then the respiratory depression brought on by the original opioid overdose could come back and potentially kill the patient, which is why it's not enough to just administer naloxone and then just send them away. Naloxone may need to be readministered, so these patients often end up going to the emergency department to get monitored. And then we talked about naltrexone. What is this one used for? It's useful in the management of alcohol addiction. The key buzzword you're going to want to know is that it helps reduce the cravings. If for whatever reason the patient has some history of liver disease, naltrexone is not good for that because it can cause hepatotoxicity. The alternative in this case would be acamprosate. But even that one you have to be careful with because it's renally excreted, so that might not be good for patients with renal failure. Okay, and then we have four other opioids that you want to know about. I'll just kind of list them out. There's tramadol, loperamide, dextromethorphan, and codeine. So tramadol, you want to be familiar with its mechanism of action. What would its mechanism of action be? So it is a mu agonist, just like most other opioids, but it has a weak affinity for it. And in addition, it has SNRI properties. So it has properties that cause serotonin reuptake inhibition as well as norepinephrine reuptake inhibition. And then there's loperamide. What is its mechanism of action? It's also a mu agonist. It's a full agonist. And what's really important about it is that it does not cross the blood-brain barrier. And because of these properties, it has a specific use. Do you know what loperamide is used for? It's to treat diarrhea. Recall earlier that we mentioned one of the symptoms of opioids, even opioid intoxication as a matter of fact, is constipation. So if somebody is experiencing diarrhea, you want to induce the opposite and try to find a balance so that they can have a normal bowel movement again. And what are dextromethorphan and codeine used for? So these are antitussives, meaning they're useful for cough. Dextromethorphan in particular has another unique mechanism of action. Do you know what that is? So dextromethorphan is an NMDA antagonist. Might not be as likely to get a question on that, but that's something you want to keep in the back of your head. Now, circling back to opioids more generally speaking, there are two effects that you really want to be familiar with. One of them is tolerance and the other is dependence. What is tolerance? So tolerance is when you need more of the drug to elicit the same effect. What is dependence? So dependence is the psychological phenomenon of drug seeking. So while tolerance is mostly referring to the molecular level, dependence is more of a psychological level. Another concept you need to be familiar with is the concept of neonatal abstinence syndrome. Okay, what is neonatal abstinence syndrome? So it's when the mother is using opioids and then baby is delivered and eventually they experience withdrawal symptoms because they no longer have opioids in their system. What kind of symptoms would you expect to see? Irritability, poor feeding, a high-pitched cry, diarrhea, yawning, sneezing, and even tremors. So this is why opioids are contraindicated in pregnancy, because the baby can be dependent on them. Now, the last concept you need to know about opioids is concerns buprenorphine versus methadone. And this is the concept of precipitated withdrawal. Can you think about what this means? Yeah, there's a lot to go over here. So first, let's do a quick review. Buprenorphine is a partial agonist and methadone is a full agonist. One thing I want to make clear, just because something is a full agonist doesn't mean it has more affinity than the partial agonist. While it might be intuitive to think that a full agonist has more affinity than a partial agonist, that is simply not the case here. What you need to know is that buprenorphine has a greater affinity for the opioid receptor than morphine, or even methadone. So what that means is that if somebody is taking a lot of morphine or a lot of methadone, and they suddenly take buprenorphine, then what's going to happen is that buprenorphine is going to displace any of the morphine and methadone in the system. And recall from earlier, buprenorphine has a ceiling effect. It has a limit on the euphoria, on the respiratory depression that somebody can feel. So by replacing the full agonist with the partial one, what you essentially did is take somebody from a full high to a partial high. And that is the effective equivalent of causing withdrawal symptoms. And this is what we call precipitated withdrawal. Okay, that was a lot. Now we're going to move on to barbiturates and benzodiazepines. Let's start with barbiturates. What are these used for? So these are primarily used as depressants of the central nervous system, and they can also be used for anesthesia. What about the mechanism of action? So these are GABA-A agonists, and what this will do is it'll increase the duration of the chloride channel influx. This is important because benzodiazepines, as we'll talk about later, increase the frequency. Intoxication of barbiturates can cause what? Respiratory depression and cardiovascular failure. And it doesn't even have an antidote. This stuff is pretty serious. It's why it's largely not in use anymore. So it won't even be as high yield on your exam. Withdrawal would include delirium, hallucination, and seizures, but you probably won't see that. What you're really going to want to know are the specific medications and then how they act. So specific ones you want to know are phenobarbital, thiopental, and primidone. One of the things you're going to want to know is the enzyme interaction. It has a specific enzyme interaction. Do you know what that is? So barbiturates are P450 inducers. Okay, this is very high yield. You're going to want to know this. Other P450 inducers, just for completeness sake, would include St. John's wort, carbamazepine, rifampin, chronic alcohol use, phenytoin, greaseofulvin, and sulfonylureas. And thiopental is particularly interesting because this one is used for anesthesia induction due to its high lipid solubility. What you're going to want to know is this key fact. It's about its metabolism. What is this key fact about its metabolism that you constantly see brought up in questions? It's the fact that its rapid metabolism, isn't necessarily due to metabolism, more so it is due to drug redistribution. Specifically, it comes on rapidly and it wears off rapidly due to the drug redistribution in skeletal muscles and adipose tissue. And the other one you're going to need to know, the other barbiturate, is primidone. And what is that primarily used for? Tremors, yes, but a better option would be propranolol. The only contraindication to that one would be if somebody can't tolerate beta blockers. An example of somebody who can't is somebody who has asthma. Now let's talk about benzodiazepines. What are the mechanism of action for these? So these are GABA-A agonists as well, but the difference is they increase the frequency of the chloride channel influx. So we know barbiturates are the duration and benzodiazepines are the frequency. And what are these used for? Main uses you want to know are anxiety and alcohol withdrawals. Other uses include status epilepticus as well as sleep. Caveat about anxiety, SSRIs and SNRIs are first line, so don't go around just throwing in benzodiazepines at somebody who has generalized anxiety disorder. Alcohol withdrawals is the key use that you're going to want to know. And intoxication for benzodiazepines, what would you expect? Altered mental status, slurred speech, ataxia, because they act on the same receptor as alcohol, you can expect a lot of the same symptoms. The only difference between an alcohol intoxication as opposed to a benzodiazepine one is that the alcohol one's going to have more abnormal vital signs. You probably won't need to know that. And then withdrawal from benzodiazepines would cause what? So it would cause rebound anxiety as well as seizures, even insomnia. And for the purposes of step one, how would you treat the benzodiazepine intoxication? You would use flumazenil. which acts on the benzodiazepine receptor as an antagonist. The benzodiazepine receptor is located on the GABA-A receptor, just something you need to know. Other important details about benzodiazepines is its metabolism. They are metabolized by the liver, with the exception of three. Can you think of the three benzodiazepines that are not metabolized by the liver? So that would be lorazepam, oxazepam, and temazepam. The mnemonic here is LOT, L-O-T. And then in addition to the fact that they are metabolized by the liver, you also need to know which ones are short, medium, and long acting, a topic that is more confusing than it needs to be. So for the short acting, all you're going to want to know is this mnemonic, which is ATOM, which stands for alprazolam, triazolam, oxazepam, and midazolam. The key thing to know about these ones is that they are highly addictive. Some long-acting benzodiazepines you want to know are chlorodiazepoxide and diazepam, and these are particularly good for alcohol withdrawal. The medium-acting ones, rarely you'll be asked a question on them, but the names of these might show up. How you differentiate these is if they have the words maze, naze, or raise in them. So temazepam has the maze word in it, clonazepam has naze, flurazepam has a raise. That's how you can tell it's medium. But honestly, the best thing to do is just look at which one is short and which one is long, and then the medium one, you can kind of fill in the gaps from there. Okay, and then alcohol withdrawal. I mean, this wouldn't be a complete discussion about benzodiazepines if we don't talk about alcohol withdrawal. The symptoms you want to know are based off the time frame. So early on, you would get mild withdrawal symptoms, which would be what? Anxiety, insomnia, tremors, diaphoresis, so on and so forth. Later on, you can expect seizures and alcoholic hallucinosis at around the 12 to 48 hour mark. The last and most serious of the complication is delirium tremens, happening around 48 to 96 hours later. This is the mega agitated, tachycardic, diaphoretic patient who's experiencing hallucinations, confusions. I mean, you'll know it when you see it. Then real briefly, I'll just kind of go over it real quick so that we can move on to the next topic. We have the quote-unquote non-benzodiazepines, zaleplon and zolpidem, metabolized by the liver. These are rapid-acting GABA-A agonists, and these help you fall asleep. If you want a medication that can help you fall and stay asleep, you want something that doesn't act as rapidly or wear off as rapidly, the one you want to use with that, for that would be azopiclone. And if for whatever reason you want to reverse the effects of these, you can also use flumazenil. And then lastly, let's talk about a few sleep medications since we're talking about zaleplon and zolpidem, which can be used for sleep. Lastly, let's talk about melatonin and remeltion. So these act on the MT1 and MT2 receptors as agonists. These receptors are located where? The suprachiasmatic nucleus of the hypothalamus. Other sleep medications you may want to know are suvorexant and deridorexant, which are orexin antagonists, which probably won't show up as much, but I figured I'd mention it for completeness sake. Okay, if you've made it this far, congratulations. I highly recommend taking a break as we're going to be moving on to mood disorders and also talk about their pharmacology. I should mention that if there are any of these topics that you feel like you need further clarification in, you can go ahead and refer to the episodes in question, specifically the one about psychoactive drug intoxication withdrawal. This was written by Tiana DiMasi. This is season 2, episode 7. The episode on opioids was written by Aditi Kothari. This was season 2, episode 18. And the episode on barbiturates and benzos was written by myself. That's season 4, episode 16. So if you want a little bit more detail about the things that we talked about, I would refer you over to those episodes. Okay, break time over. Let's talk about major depressive disorder to start with. The things you're going to want to know are the timeline. So let's first talk about that. What's the timeline for the symptoms of major depressive disorder? So about 2 weeks. And what symptoms am I referring to? The Sigi Cap symptoms. So what does the S stand for? The S stands for sleep, specifically decreased sleep. The I stands for interest, specifically decreased interest. This is also known as anhedonia. G stands for guilt, so increased guilt. And E, decreased energy. C, decreased concentration. A, decreased appetite. P, psychomotor retardation, which is also known as slower body movement. Though of note, I have seen practice questions where it's not psychomotor retardation, but psychomotor agitation. Okay, so that's like restlessness. And then what does the S stand for? Suicidal ideation. And they may not use this in the question stem because it's kind of a dead giveaway, but don't be surprised if they do. Last thing you want to know is how many of the Sigi Cap symptoms. Usually 5 or more. One of them has to be depression or anhedonia. So now moving on to the pharmacology for major depressive disorder. You're going to want to know about SSRIs, SNRIs, TCAs, atypical antidepressants, as well as MAO inhibitors. So I'll first provide a rapid review of SSRIs, some of the nitty-gritty for step one in particular, just to kind of save some time here. So one of the things you want to know about SSRIs, they stand for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Serotonin is derived from tryptophan, which is why serotonin, if you look at how it's written, sometimes it's written as 5-HT, which stands for 5-hydroxytryptamine. And this is also known as a monoamine. This is one of the three monoamines you want to know. And the other monoamines are dopamine and norepinephrine. And serotonin is synthesized in two places. One of them is the raphe nucleus, and the other are the enterochromaffin cells in the intestine. So knowing SSRIs, or at least the class of medication, isn't enough. You also have to know the names. Key names you're going to want to know: citalopram, escitalopram, fluoxetine, paroxetine, and sertraline. You may also see fluvoxamine, but that's a bit lower yield. Now, if you see a psychiatric condition and you're not sure what to use, very likely the answer is going to be an SSRI, because these are used for not only major depressive disorder, but also OCD, PTSD, panic disorder, general anxiety disorder, bulimia disorder, binge eating, social phobias, hoarding, etc., etc., etc. Not a list to memorize, but just know that these are highly versatile. One of the things you really want to know are how long it takes to work. So how long does it take for SSRIs to work? About 1 to 2 months. You also want to know about its side effect profile. So what are some of the side effects you'd expect to see? So weight gain, insomnia, anorgasmia, those are some of the big ones you want to know. Even more high yield than that is suicidal ideation. So this is due to what's called the energizing phenomenon. You don't necessarily need to know that term, but the idea is that people who are depressed usually feel so not motivated that they don't even want to take their own life, and then an SSRI like gives them energy to do so. So that's something that you may want to know. Another thing that you want to know is that before prescribing an SSRI, you want to rule out that the patient has any symptoms of bipolar disorder. Why do you want to do that? Is because if you don't, then you're going to precipitate mania. And the last thing you want to know about SSRIs is that just as they come on very slowly, you also have to taper them very slowly. And if you don't, what happens? What happens is that the patient will be experiencing flu-like symptoms. So now really quickly, let's talk about the SNRIs. So norepinephrine is derived from tyrosine, and these are synthesized in the adrenal medulla. The names that you're going to want to know are venlafaxine and duloxetine. Now, what are the uses of SNRIs? So in addition to depression, they are also used for neuropathy and fibromyalgia. So that's when you would use an SNRI over an SSRI. It's that multifaceted use. Neuropathy would include the weakness, numbness, and pain, usually associated with a past medical history of diabetes. And then fibromyalgia is when a patient describes that they have pain all over. This is usually elicited with various tender points on the body. One of the highest yield side effects you're going to want to know about SNRIs are hypertension. So SNRIs can cause hypertension. It's one of the highest yield side effects you're going to want to know. And this is due to the alpha-1 agonism associated with the norepinephrine, whose reuptake has been inhibited. And then we're going to talk about TCAs. These are variants of SNRIs, but the really big thing that you're going to want to know are its side effect profile. Because it is so extensive, I'm just going to go over them. So you're going to want to know that these are anticholinergic. To understand what anticholinergic mean, it helps to understand what cholinergic symptoms look like. You might have heard of the dumbbells mnemonic. So that's cholinergic. That's diarrhea, urination, meiosis, bradycardia, emesis, lacrimation, lethargy, and salivation. So anticholinergic would be the opposite. Constipation, urinary retention, mydriasis, tachycardia, ileus, anhydrosis, delirium, xerostomia. You also want to know that TCAs are antihistaminic, and what that means is that these are helpful for sedation. And you also want to know that they are anti-adrenergic. That's just something that you need to memorize, not the most important. You're most likely going to be asked about its anticholinergic and antihistaminic effects. And then, of course, you're going to want to know the names. It's not enough to know the class. So names you want to familiarize yourself with are amitriptyline, imipramine, and clomipramine. These are the tertiary TCAs. And then you have your secondary TCAs, nortriptyline and desipramine. To get even more granular, let's talk about specific TCAs. Imipramine in particular is great to help treat enuresis. Clomipramine is indicated in the treatment of OCD. Desipramine is the least antihistaminic of all the TCAs, so this is the one that's safer for the elderly. And doxepin, you probably might not see this, but just for completeness sake, doxepin is the most antihistaminic. I'm only mentioning this just in case. Now, the side effect profile for these also includes weight gain, insomnia, and orgasmia, but what you really want to focus on for TCAs are the three C's. And what are the three C's? Cardiotoxicity, convulsions, and coma. So the cardiotoxicity, what it does is it can cause QT prolongation, eventually torsades. So this is when you have your wide QRS complexes. How would you treat this? You would treat this using baking soda, aka sodium bicarbonate. The convulsions is likely due to electrolyte disturbances, which can cause seizures, okay? And the coma is likely secondary to arrhythmia. The cardiotoxicity of the three that I mentioned is the most high-yield one you're going to want to know. I'd be surprised if they ask you questions about the other ones. And the last side effect you want to be familiar with, it's honestly just something you're going to need to memorize because of its anti-adrenergic effects. It's orthostatic hypotension. Now moving on to the atypical antidepressants. When I say atypicals, I'm referring to the drug, not to the fact that they treat atypical depression. Those are two different things. So the first one is bupropion. We mentioned this earlier in the episode. Can you recall the mechanism of action? It's a norepinephrine and dopamine reuptake inhibitor. Now you may recall that it is useful for smoking cessation. What else is it useful for? It's also useful for weight loss, and it's also useful for the fact that it doesn't have any sexual side effects. But it does have a key side effect that you're going to want to know, and what is that? It lowers the seizure threshold, so you want to caution folks who have eating disorders or epilepsy. Now, because I want to make sure you get these questions right on the exam, I'm going to give you a quick test-taking pearl. So the patient on a question stem might have an eating disorder, but they may not mention it explicitly. What they might do instead is they'll give you lab values. And if you see anything that looks like hypokalemia, hypochloremia, or elevated bicarbonate, that's likely due to contraction alkalosis secondary to vomiting. The implication there is that the patient has an eating disorder, so do not prescribe bupropion in that patient. Then the other ones that you're going to be familiar with, aside from bupropion, are trazodone and mirtazapine. So trazodone primarily acts as a serotonin antagonist, specifically on 5-HT2, whereas mirtazapine acts on 5-HT2 and 3. Key things you're going to want to know about both of these are the side effects. So both of them share a common side effect, which is sedation. The way I remember this is, instead of calling it trazodone and mirtazapine, I call it trazodone and mirtazapine. And the ZZZ kind of reminds me of sleep. So trazodone and mirtazapine, great for sedation. And unique to trazodone is one really interesting side effect. Do you know what this, which one I'm referring to? So I'm referring to priapism. It's also known as a painful erection. You might have heard the mnemonic trazabone. And then mirtazapine, what is its unique side effect? Weight gain. And that's really all you need to know about atypical antidepressants. Now we're going to move on to monoamine oxidase inhibitors. So these medications are actually responsible for treating atypical depression. Real quick, what is atypical depression? So it's a bit different from a SIGI-CAPS. Symptoms you can expect to see are hyperphagia, hypersomnia, mood reactivity, lead in paralysis, and sensitivity to rejection. Another thing you're going to want to know for step one, you're going to need to know the pharmacological mechanisms of MAO inhibitors in pretty explicit detail. And I go over those in season 3, episode 24. It would be way too long for the sake of rapid review, so I'm going to refer you over to that episode. But what I'll give you instead is the quick TLDR. What you'll need to know is that MAO inhibitors inhibit the breakdown of monoamines. Can you recall from earlier what the monoamines are? Norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin. And they do so in the presynaptic neuron, which increases their availability. Now, is this reversible or irreversible? So MAO inhibitors act irreversibly. And there are different types of MAO inhibitors. There is the non-selective variants and the selective variants. The non-selective ones, the names you're going to want to know, are isocarboxazide, tranylcypramine, and phenelazine. Okay, so these act on MAO-A and MAO-B, meaning they help to inhibit the breakdown of norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin. This is different than selective monoamine oxidase inhibitors. Those are selegiline and resegiline. These only act on MAO-B. And because they only act on MAO-B, they act on one specific neurotransmitter, and that is dopamine, which is why it can be useful in the setting of Parkinson's. Now, I should mention, I'm not going to go over that in too much detail. If you want to know more about Parkinson's pharmacology, see Rachel Garza's episode for more details. That is season 3, episode 17. And I also do have some helpful mnemonics to understand more of these antidepressants, as well as these atypicals and these MAO inhibitors in season 3, episode 24. I'm not going to talk about those here for the sake of time. One thing you will need to know about monoamine inhibitors is its side effect profile. It has to do with tyramine. Can you think of what that is? So it's the tyramine-induced hypertensive crisis. And what's going to happen is tyramine accumulates in the presynaptic neuron, displaces norepinephrine, and then the norepinephrine goes into the postsynaptic area, and that's going to cause lots of hypertension. Now, where is tyramine normally found? Key areas you want to look for: wines, cheeses, and less high yield or cured meats. But the wines and cheeses are the ones you're really going to want to know about. And for the sake of completion, I'm going to briefly talk about serotonin syndrome. No questions here, just strap yourself in. So this happens when you have multiple meds that cause a serotonin increase. So you have an interaction between SSRIs and SNRIs, for example, or SSRIs and TCAs, for example. Examiners also love to go after other lower yield causes for serotonin syndrome, like the interaction with serotonergic drugs such as tramadol, dextromethorphan, even linezolid. Symptoms that you're going to want to know: fever, tachycardia, hypertension, agitation, diaphoresis. These are the general ones. The really incredibly high-yield ones you want to know are diarrhea and colonus, okay? This is very different than neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which we'll talk about later. That's caused by antipsychotics, and that causes rigidity with elevated creatinine kinase and white blood cells. And the treatment for serotonin syndrome, you want to discontinue any of the meds that they're on. You want to provide them with some symptomatic treatment. But for the purposes of step one, the key medications you want to know is cyproheptadine. And that acts as a serotonin antagonist on 5-HT1 and 2. So now let's talk about bipolar disorder. There's type 1 and type 2. Both are characterized by DIGFAST symptoms. And what are the DIGFAST symptoms? So let's start with the D. So the D stands for distractibility. I stands for impulsivity. G, grandiosity. F, flight of ideas. A, activity increase. S, sleep deficit. And T, talkativeness. What can be confusing about mania, especially bipolar mania 1, is that can also include psychotic symptoms such as hallucinations and delusions, the likes of which are also seen in schizophrenia. I would strongly refer you to my schizophrenia episode in season 4, episode 11, for details on how to distinguish mania versus schizophrenia. Of course, a discussion about bipolar disorder would be incomplete without a discussion of its pharmacology. We're now going to move on to talking about mood stabilizers. The first one is going to be lithium. The big thing you want to know about this, other than the fact that it helps treat bipolar disorder, is its side effect profile. That's the very high yield stuff. And the reason you want to know about its side effect profile is because it has a narrow therapeutic index. And a narrow therapeutic index, by way of review, is real quickly, it's just small margin between when a drug is therapeutic versus when a drug causes problems. And when it does cause problems, some easy ones right off the top of the head that you need to know are GI upset acutely, so that would be nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. Chronically, it could be neurologic deficits like tremor, ataxia, and confusion. But some of the more high-yield ones are the endocrine complications. So what are the two endocrine complications that you need to know about lithium toxicity? So hypothyroidism is one. Again, it's like the weight gain, the hair loss, dry skin, constipation. The other one is nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. In addition to those, you also need to be familiar with some of the drug-drug interactions associated with lithium. The two big ones that you're going to want to know are the thiazide interaction and the NSAID interaction. And what this will do is it'll increase the levels of lithium. And again, I'd refer you over to season 3, episode 25, the third part on mood disorders. That'll cover the pharmacology for mood stabilizers in greater detail if you want to know why that is the case. But that'd be a little out of scope for this discussion. And the last thing you want to know is about lithium and its relationship to pregnancy. So what is the key side effect when we're thinking about lithium and pregnancy? So we're thinking about Epstein's anomaly. Recall that this is the congenital defect where you have a downwardly displaced tricuspid causing an enlarged right atrium. So on auscultation, you can expect to hear a holosystolic murmur because it would cause a tricuspid regurgitation. And just by way of review, other causes of holosystolic murmurs include mitral regurgitation and ventricular septal defect. The next big mood stabilizer you want to know about is valproate. This is also an anti-epileptic, but it can be used for the treatment of bipolar disorder. So what is its mechanism of action? So it has two. It's a sodium channel inactivator, as well as a GABA transaminase inactivator. What is its special enzyme interaction? So valproate is an inhibitor of the P450 system. Some of the highest yield P450 inhibitors that I can recall are isoniazid, grapefruit juice, and some of the azole drugs like ketoconazole, fluconazole. And what are some of the side effects associated with valproic acid? So there are quite a bit. I usually divide this into two categories. There's the GI side effects and the neuro side effects. So the GI ones would be the basic nausea, vomiting, appetite increase, which would cause weight gain, to some more serious stuff like hepatotoxicity, and even more serious stuff like pancreatitis. The neurologic side effects would include tremors, and then even more seriously, neural tube defects, which is why valproic acid is contraindicated in pregnancy. Now, the next two drugs I'm going to talk about are lower yield, but I'll mention them for the sake of completeness. They are carbamazepine and lamotrigine. Okay, so carbamazepine is used for acute mania and prevention of acute mania. Now, knowing that isn't as important as knowing some of its side effects and its mechanism of action. So what is the mechanism of action of carbamazepine? So this is a sodium channel inactivator. In just a sodium channel inactivator, whereas valproic acid does that, and GABA transaminase inactivation, carbamazepine just a sodium channel inactivation. Special things you want to know about carbamazepine, it's usually first line for trigeminal neuralgia, and recall from earlier, carbamazepine showed up in that list of P450 inducers, so remember that. Now, side effects of carbamazepine, just try to think of as many as you can. I'll give you about 5 seconds. Yep, there are a lot. So the word carbamazepine has 5 syllables, so I break it down into 5 categories. You have the balance side effects, dermatologic, endocrinologic, hematologic, as well as neuro side effects. From the balance standpoint, you can get diplopia and ataxia. And the way I remember that is kind of, if you have double vision, you're gonna lose balance. And dermatologically, you can get Stevens-Johnson's. From the endocrine standpoint, you can get SIADH. Hematologically, there's a syndrome called DRESS, that's drug rash with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms. This is a delayed drug-induced type 4 reaction, type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. In addition to that, you can also get agranulocytosis, which is when you have low white blood cell counts. Other key drugs you want to know that cause agranulocytosis are ganciclovir, colchicine, propylthiouracil, methimazole, and clozapine. And then it can also cause aplastic anemia, so when the bone marrow can no longer make RBCs. And then neurologically, it can also cause neural tube defects, just like valproic acid, so there's a contraindication in pregnancy. And now moving on to lamotrigine, it's primarily used for maintenance therapy of bipolar disorder. What is the mechanism of action here? Same as carbamazepine, it's a sodium channel inactivator. And what about its side effect profile? Can you think of some? Fortunately, not nearly as many. There are side effects concerning the skin and those concerning the eyes. So concerning the skin, about 10% of patients experience a rash. That one's pretty common. What's less common is the Stevens-Johnson's rash, but that is also a side effect that you want to be aware of. And then for the eyes, diplopia. Okay, now at this point we would normally move on to antipsychotics, but I figured I'd just skip over that and save that for when we talk about schizophrenia. For now, we're going to move on to some other mood disorders that are not as high yield as major depression or bipolar, but it's something you should know for the purposes of board examinations. So the first one we want to know is about persistent depressive disorder. Can you tell me what that is? So this is somebody experiencing SGICAP symptoms, but there are a few key differences. The first one is that they are not experiencing as many SGICAP symptoms. And then the second key difference is the timeline. Persistent depressive disorder happens over a course of 2 years. That's very high yield. So if the time frame isn't 2 years, don't even think about this, okay? Then the next one is cyclothymic disorder. Can you tell me what that is? So this can get confused for bipolar disorder, but they are different. Cyclothymic disorder is when you have alternating states of hypomania and dysthymia. So it's basically bipolar type 2 without the signs of major depressive disorder. So earlier we talked about persistent depressive disorder. It's worth mentioning that that is sometimes also known as dysthymia or dysthymia, however you pronounce it. And recall that that is less SGICAP symptoms than somebody experiencing major depressive disorder. So cyclothymia has its ups, has its downs, but never as low as major depression disorder. Another key thing you need to know is the time frame. What's important about the time frame here? So like persistent depressive disorder, 2 years is the timeline. Again, do not pick cyclothymia or persistent depressive disorder if you do not see a time frame of about 2 years. One other fact that you may want to know is that in the setting of cyclothymia, the patients can express that they have about 2 months of normal symptoms, but that's kind of on the lower yield end of things. Just know the alternating hypomania and dysthymia for about 2 years and you should be good to go. And now the next thing is adjustment disorder. What is that? It's pretty much what it sounds like. It's a situational depression, but it's in reference to an acute stressor. Think a job scare, health scare, marital concerns. The stressor will be easily identifiable on the question stem. Now, what about the time frame for this? Less than 6 months. If it's greater than 6 months, you're probably looking at something else. Next, I want to talk about real quickly the difference between normal and pathologic grief. So what is normal grief? So that's a grief over the loss of a loved one without a loss of function. The time frame for this one is less than a year. Here's the problem. If it becomes pathologic, if there is loss of function, regardless of the time frame, or if the symptoms have been going on greater than a year, okay? And when I say loss of function, I'm usually referring to the SGICAP symptoms. So if somebody is experiencing SGICAPs, that's a loss of function. Then the last thing I want to mention is postpartum blues versus depression versus psychosis. So what is postpartum blues? So it's the blues. It's sadness after, you know, postpartum. Nothing too scary here. Postpartum depression, on the other hand, what's that? That's the loss of function. That's the SGICAPs. So kind of like how we talked about normal grief versus pathologic grief, where normal does not have SGICAPs and pathologic does, postpartum blues and depression are kind of similar, where postpartum blues does not have SGICAPs, postpartum depression does. Postpartum psychosis, what is that? That's the scary stuff, okay? That's the one where the patients are completely out of it. They have thoughts about wanting to hurt their baby. I mean, this is the stuff that you really want to be wary about. The time frame for these are usually within a month. how you manage these is postpartum blues. You don't give anything for that. Postpartum depression, since it's Sigi CAPS, it warrants an SSRI. Postpartum psychosis, they'll probably ask you about the management here. You gotta hospitalize the mother. You cannot leave them alone with the baby. Okay, now we're gonna move on to schizophrenia. This is in reference to season 4, episode 11. I highly recommend listening to that episode in its, you know, purity, because it's more about recognizing the pattern of schizophrenia as opposed to just memorizing the symptoms. And in that episode, I talk about how we can differentiate schizophrenia from delusions, dementia, delirium, personality disorders, mood disorders, etc. And I believe that this requires way more detail than a rapid review can, you know, encapsulate. But the short and sweet that you have to know is that schizophrenia is diagnosed in the absence of other causes, okay? Now, what are some of the symptoms that you're going to look for in order to help guide you towards a diagnosis of schizophrenia? Yeah, so you have your positive and your negative symptoms. What are some positive symptoms you can think of? So you have hallucinations, delusions, and disorganized speech and behavior, okay? And what about the negative symptoms? So this is the four A's: avolition, flat affect, alogia, which is less words, and a disheveled appearance. And just as with most psych questions on the board exams, the timeline is really important. If these symptoms are going for less than a month, what will we call that? Brief psychotic disorder. If it's 1 to 6 months, schizophreniform. Anything greater than that is when we call it schizophrenia. Now, earlier I said schizophrenia is diagnosed in the absence of other causes. I'm going to give a quick example as to what that would mean. So we talked about how schizophrenia can have hallucinations and delusions. You know what else can have hallucinations and delusions? Drug use. So would you diagnose a drug use, or were you diagnosed with schizophrenia? You're going to diagnose the drug use. If there's no drug use and really nothing else identifiable that's causing those symptoms, only then would you diagnose schizophrenia. And again, I go over more details about that in my schizophrenia episode. Now, although schizophrenia is a topic that isn't very great to review rapidly, there is one more thing I want to talk about that's super important, and that is schizoaffective disorder, because this can be very confusing. I'll paint this scenario. So let's say we have a patient that comes in. They have manic symptoms for about a week. So you're reading the question, you're thinking, oh yeah, this is bipolar type 1. But then you read the question stem, and then it mentions outside of the manic episode, the patient was experiencing 2+ weeks of delusions. So what is unique about this question presentation is that you think it's bipolar type 1, however, you have a 2-week period where the patient was experiencing delusions that had nothing to do with the manic episode. This essentially means, if translated to plain English, that the patient is primarily experiencing symptoms of schizophrenia, kind of at a baseline, but occasionally his symptoms worsen to where the patient becomes manic. Now, for the purposes of board examinations, it's highly unlikely that someone is going to go to the emergency department because they're hearing voices. They're probably going to go to the emergency department if they're experiencing full-blown mania. But I should reiterate, just because the patient is experiencing a manic episode does not mean that they have a diagnosis of bipolar type 1. You gotta make sure that you read the question stem. If they mention anything about schizophrenic symptoms outside the manic episode, you are looking at a diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder. Of course, a discussion about schizophrenia is incomplete without a discussion of antipsychotics. We're first going to talk about the first generation, and then we're going to talk about the second generation. So the first generation, so some names you want to be familiar with are haloperidol, trifluoperazine, chlorpromazine, thioridazine, and flufenazine. The most high yield of the bunch is haloperidol. It's the one that shows up time and time again when referring to first generation antipsychotics. And other than psychosis, what can these be used for? So it can be used for mania, though we usually use them for second generation antipsychotics. When we're referring to schizophrenia, are we talking about positive symptoms or negative symptoms? Which of these do the first generation treat? Yeah, they generally treat the positive symptoms. And one other interesting use for first generation antipsychotics is in the treatment of Tourette's. Recall that Tourette's is diagnosed with motor and vocal tics presenting for at least a year. And what is the mechanism of action for these first-generation antipsychotics? D2 antagonism. Another thing you should know is that these first-generation antipsychotics are divided into high potency and low potency. This is a bit lower yield, but real quickly, the high potency ones are haloperidol, trifluperazine, and flufenazine, and then low potency ones are chlorpromazine and thioridazine. And the side effect profile will vary based off its potency. So the high potency ones are more likely to cause the symptoms we're about to talk about. So what is the biggest side effect that you need to know for antipsychotics? The extrapyramidal symptoms, commonly referred to as EPS. And for EPS, you want to know the timeline. So we have symptoms that occur within the first few hours versus the first few days and weeks, and then months. So in the first few hours, what kind of EPS can you expect? So you can expect acute dystonia. So this is when patients have abnormal posture, skewed eyes, a wide open jaw. I don't know if you need to know treatments, but I'll just mention it briefly. Treatments for acute dystonia include diphenhydramine, aka Benadryl, and benztropine. Within days to weeks for EPS, what can you expect? So you can expect akathisia, which is restlessness, as well as Parkinsonian features. Treatments for these, the akathisia is best treated with either benztropines, benzodiazepines, or beta blockers. The Parkinsonian features, either benztropine or amantadine. And then the EPS symptoms that occur after months of antipsychotic use, what would this be? So this would be tardive dyskinesia, tardy meaning late, dys irregular, kinesia movement, so a late onset of irregular movement. So this is your lip smacking, tongue protrusions, your rapid blinking, grimacing, and frowning, and this is usually treated with either valbenazine or deuterobenazine. In addition to that, there are some unique side effects concerning the low potency antipsychotics, the chlorpromazine and thioridazine. I honestly don't see this too much on board exams, but I'll mention them anyway. So the first set of side effects you want to know are the ophthalmologic ones. For chlorpromazine, what would you expect for the eyes? You'd expect corneal deposits. And what about thioridazine? Retinal deposits. So in addition to that, you have anti-muscarinic, antihistaminic, and anti-alpha adrenergic symptoms. So anti-muscarinic, recall, this is your dry mouth, your constipation. Antihistaminic is your sedation. And anti-alpha adrenergic, this is your orthostatic hypotension. So now we'll talk about the side effects that are relevant to both of the antipsychotics, both high and low potency. So you have your endocrinologic side effects, your neurologic side effects, as well as your cardio ones. So endocrinologically, what can you expect? You can expect hyperprolactinemia, and this is due to the blockade of dopamine. Neurologically, what can you expect? You can expect NMS. This is neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So similar to serotonin syndrome, you have your fever, tachycardia, hypertension, agitation, diaphoresis, the usual stuff. But what's different is the patient will be extremely rigid and they'll have an elevated creatine kinase as well as an elevated white blood cell count. Can you remember what makes serotonin syndrome unique? The diarrhea and the clonus. Okay, so again, serotonin syndrome, diarrhea, clonus, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, creatine kinase, white blood cell, rigidity. And then the cardio side effects of antipsychotics is QT prolongation, which can cause torsades. Very dangerous. Okay, now moving right along to the second generation, aka atypical antipsychotics. Names you want to be familiar with: olanzapine, clozapine, or clozapine, however you want to pronounce it, quetiapine, ziprasidone, lurasidone, risperidone, and aripiprazole. Not to be confused with omeprazole, those are very different. So these are the medications that are given in conjunction with bipolar treatment if you notice any psychotic features or other severe features such as aggression, multiple hospitalizations for psychiatric reasons. How much of that you need to know? Not that much, but it's good to have in the back of your head. In addition to psychotic symptoms and mania, what sort of symptoms of schizophrenia can you treat, the positive or the negative? So it can actually treat both. The way I remember this is it's second generation, so it has a number 2, so it treats two types of schizophrenia symptoms. Can second generation antipsychotics treat Tourette's? One of them can. Do you know which one? That would be risperidone. Okay, and then lower yield for the purposes of board examinations. These atypical antipsychotics can also help treat treatment-resistant depression and OCD, but don't worry about that if you don't know it. And what's the mechanism of action for these? So in the real world, it's highly variable, but for the purposes of board examinations, dopamine antagonism, D2, as well as some serotonin antagonism, so 5-HT2 specifically. And side effects, what kind of side effects would you expect out of these atypical antipsychotics? So it kind of depends on which one you're talking about, but generally speaking, you're going to have your antihistamine, anti-alpha adrenergic, anti-muscarinic effects, as well as your QT prolongation, where, as a side note, ziprasidone is the most likely to cause QT prolongation. And then you want to know about metabolic dysfunction. So this is your weight gain, dyslipidemia, and hyperglycemia. The most likely medications to cause this would be olanzapine and clozapine. Olanzapine is the easier one to remember because it has the big O, and the way I remember the big O is that I imagine somebody with a lot of belly fat. So I just think of that and then draw an O around the belly fat, and that's olanzapine. It's a weird way to remember it, but it works for me. And then the other ones you want to know about for side effects are the ones concerning clozapine and risperidone. So first thing you want to know about clozapine before I mention its side effects, that's the medication that's given to people who have failed two trials of antipsychotics. So this is the big guns. It's going to have the most serious side effects. So what are the side effects of clozapine that you need to know? So there are three. There's the neutropenia, so you're going to have a low white blood cell count. The myocarditis, so if you see a patient with chest pain, shortness of breath, exertional dyspnea in the setting of clozapine use, you want to consider the drug interaction, as well as seizures. And then lastly, you want to know about the side effects of risperidone. So what's unique about risperidone? So risperidone is the most likely to cause extrapyramidal symptoms. That might be something you might be asked on the exam, but even more important than that, and arguably even more high yield, you can practically ignore what I just said. The most high yield fact about risperidone is the hyperprolactinemia. And I talk a lot about the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis in detail in season 3, episode 25, if you're curious on wanting a review for that. And then the last fun fact you should know about atypical antipsychotics, just something to tuck away in the back of your head, aripiprazole is the only one of these medications that has partial D2 agonism. Just something to note. Don't freak out if you don't know it. Okay, and with that, we've wrapped up all the more difficult and dense topics of psychiatry. So now we're going to move on to the easier stuff. We're going to start with personality disorders. So the brief overview of personality disorders is it's a rigid way of thinking with a pervasive pattern of behavior, usually going on for years, often beginning in adulthood. It's not diagnosed in kids, and it's egosyntonic. Now, what does it mean to be egosyntonic? So egosyntonic is that which is in line with your beliefs. Okay? And like schizophrenia, remember how we talked about schizophrenia being diagnosed in the absence of other clearly identifiable causes? Personality disorders kind of work similarly. They are diagnosed in the absence of other clearly identifiable causes. There are three clusters: cluster A, B, and C. So cluster A, what are the personality disorders in cluster A? So you have schizoid, schizotypal, and paranoid. Cluster B, borderline, antisocial, histrionic, narcissistic. Cluster C, avoidant, dependent, and OCPD, which is obsessive compulsive personality disorder. What does it mean to be schizoid? So this is somebody who voluntarily isolates themselves. They have no problem being alone. That they are content with that. That's all you need to know about that. What about schizotypal? So it's very similar to schizoid. The only difference, and it's a key one, they also have odd, eccentric, or even magical thinking. So an example of this would be somebody who likes to carry a spell book with them to ward off evil. Kind of magical thinking. That's what you would expect for somebody with a schizotypal personality disorder. And then what about somebody who is paranoid? So this is somebody who is permanently suspicious. Let's give an example here. Suppose somebody is receiving praise from work. Now the problem here is somebody who is paranoid would believe that the praise is disingenuous or that it's coming from somebody who's trying to make them look nice only to sweep the rug from under them. That is something that is, you know, within reality. Like, it's plausible. You could potentially see this happening in reality, so that's what paranoid would be. This is different from somebody who receives praise from work only to believe that the person is doing so merely to put on a front for when they inevitably poison their food. Now, that's a bit far off. That would not be paranoid personality disorder. That'd be something else. And that something else would be paranoid delusions. So a little bit different. So now moving on to cluster B. So we start off with borderline personality disorder. What kind of traits would you expect with somebody with this disorder? So you'd expect some drastic mood swings, unstable relationships, they're highly impulsive, so they have usually a long history of multiple suicide attempts. You probably immediately thought of splitting, and if you did, what is splitting? So it's when they see things as 100% good, 100% bad, so black or white. Usually in patients like this, you're going to see a history of childhood trauma. And very, very, very high yield for the purposes of board exams, you're going to want to know the treatment and what is the treatment for borderline. DBT, it's dialectical behavior therapy. Next, let's talk about antisocial personality disorder. What is this? So this is the worst possible behavior you can see from anybody. Anything from crimes, manipulation, vandalism, a general disregard for the well-being of others has nothing to do with their social skills. It's similar to conduct disorder. The only difference is conduct disorder is basically antisocial for kids. And what about histrionic? So somebody who is histrionic is somebody who is attention-seeking. Now, when people think histrionic, they often think of somebody who is hypersexual. But don't forget about the other traits. So the other traits of histrionic personality disorder is somebody who is overly extroverted or dramatic. So those are also some things that you can look for. And what about narcissistic personality disorder? What would you expect? Pretty self-explanatory. You've heard the term a lot. I mean, this is somebody who's entitled, egocentric, grandiose. They just lack empathy for others, but not to antisocial levels. When we think antisocial, we usually think of criminality. When we think of narcissism, we think of somebody who sees themselves as superior to other people. Now, moving on to cluster C, what is avoidant personality disorder? So this one actually has to do with social skills. This is somebody who is socially isolated, but they desire to be social. This is different than schizoid because the schizoid person is content with isolation. The person who is avoidant, they're not happy with that at all. They want to be social, but they just can't bring themselves to do it. And what about dependent personality disorder? Exactly what it sounds like. This is somebody who has a reliance on somebody else. They have fear of abandonment. They are willing to overcompromise even at their own expense. And in OCPD, what would that be? So breaking it down, obsession is a thought, compulsion is a desire to act. So this is somebody who's type A to the extreme. They are spending a disproportionate amount of time on trivial tasks like organizing calendars or grammar proofreading. Now, this might sound like OCD, but what is the key difference between OCD and OCPD? So OCD is ego dystonic. OCPD is ego syntonic. Because recall from earlier, personality disorders, ego syntonic, in line with your thought process. And what would the treatment for this be? You know, when in doubt, CBT, don't overthink this. You know, O is obsession, it's a thought. And then the compulsion is a behavior. So if you want to treat the thought, you look at the cognition portion. You want to treat the behavioral, so cognitive behavioral therapy. Nice and simple, short and sweet. Okay, second to last topic is defense mechanisms. So real quickly, defense mechanisms are a balance between superego, which is your morality, versus your id, which are your desires. And you're reconciling them through your ego. You do this either unconsciously, this is known as immature, or consciously, which is known as mature. Now, in my episode on defense mechanisms, I mentioned 17 immature defense mechanisms with 4 mature defense mechanisms. 8 of the immature defense mechanisms are lower yield, so I'll actually forego those for the sake of the rapid review. I'll talk about the 9 must-know immature defense mechanisms, as well as the 4 mature defense mechanisms, because you need to know all 4 mature defense mechanisms. Okay, so the first ones we're going to talk about are displacement versus projection. Now, this is the first 2 of the 9 immature defense mechanisms we're going to talk about for this rapid review. So what's the difference between the two? So displacement is when you take feelings out on a third party. Projection is the attribution of internal feelings towards them. Okay, so a difference would be, for example, in displacement, you'd have coworkers who are arguing, and then one of the coworkers goes home to yell at the significant other. That's different from somebody who say they feel like they suck at life, and then they tell their friend they suck at life. That's projection. So projection is more of a thought. You're just kind of attributing thought to somebody, and displacement is more of the action. Isolation of affect. What is that? This one's kind of self-explanatory. It's when you separate your emotions from your ideas. For example, if somebody has a blank face when discussing a recent trauma as opposed to sadness. Now, what about rationalization versus intellectualization? So, I want to make this clear. Rationalization, as logical as the word sounds, is the same thing as excuse-making. Okay, so when you think of rationalization, think of somebody who's making excuses. Intellectualization, on the other hand, is to somebody who focuses on the non-emotional aspects of something. So, for example, they get a diagnosis of cancer, and rather than just, like, sit and cry about it, they do research on the diagnosis, treatments, and lifestyle modifications. And what's the difference between reaction formation versus sublimation? Okay, so we actually have our first mature defense mechanism here, and that is sublimation. So let's first talk about reaction formation. This is when you feel one way, but your actions say otherwise. For example, let's say you have a racist uncle that you absolutely despise with a burning passion, but then you look out for that uncle when he's sick. So your actions are not in line with your thoughts and feelings. Sublimation, your first defense mechanism, is when you channel negative energy into something positive. So somebody who has anger issues goes to a boxing class. It's like finding a healthy outlet for your expression. And then let's talk about the differences between repression, suppression, and denial. So what is repression? So repression is when you involuntarily withhold information, like you're blocking out traumatic thoughts as if they aren't even there. Suppression, on the other hand, what is that? Yes, it's our second mature defense mechanism on this list. It's when you voluntarily withhold information that you've already accepted as reality. So somebody who just took an exam who says, well, you know, it is what it is, I'm not going to think about it. And what is denial? So denial is just avoiding reality altogether. This is somebody who, you know, denies the passing of a loved one or denies that they've been diagnosed with cancer, even though, you know, all the labs and all the imaging points towards it. And then what about splitting? Yeah, we already talked about it earlier. So this is when somebody is seeing things in black and white, 100% good, 100% bad. Okay, so we already covered 9 of the highest yield immature defense mechanisms and 2 of the highest yield mature defense mechanisms. Let's talk about the other 2 mature defense mechanisms. You have altruism and humor. So what is altruism? So altruism is when somebody gives charity to alleviate guilt. Okay, so this is somebody who, for example, feels bad for bullying somebody on Instagram, and then they feel so bad about it, they decide, oh man, I'm going to donate to a cyberbullying fund. And then humor, what is that? Exactly what it sounds like. Don't have to overthink that. It's just jokes. Think of somebody who's like making memes for med school, right? Just to kind of cope. That's what humor is. Okay, and then the last thing I want to talk about are transference and countertransference. These aren't exactly defense mechanisms. I'll just briefly talk about it. So transference is when a patient attributes feelings about important people onto the physician. So for example, if a patient dislikes their dad and the doctor reminds them of their dad, then the patient dislikes the doctor. Countertransference is the same thing, but the other way around. So the doctor dislikes the dad, patient reminds the doctor of their dad, so then the doctor dislikes the patient. Now, if you want to know more of the less high-yield defense mechanisms, you can see my episode on Season 3, Episode 27. But we're going to move on to our last topic. This one is short and sweet. It is psychotherapy. So for this one, we're only going to talk about three. There are five lower-yield ones that are biofeedback, interpersonal, psychodynamic, supportive, and family therapy, but I'm going to skip those for the rapid review. The three you absolutely must need to know are CBT, DBT, and motivational interviewing. So to the best of your knowledge, what is CBT? So CBT is a psychotherapy that's targeting maladaptive thoughts and patterns. So examples would include the treatment of OCD. We talked about it earlier, how OCD and OCPD can be treated with CBT. And it's a lot of abbreviations. Other uses for it are acute stress disorder, PTSD, depression, ADHD, insomnia, and so on. So point being, when in doubt, CBT for the purposes of examinations. I'll mention one thing about CBT is that there are many subsets of it. For example, one that you may be familiar with is exposure therapy. So that could be great for specific phobias. So if somebody's afraid of heights or needles or spiders. And then trauma-focused therapy is another variant of CBT. So that can be used for PTSD. Just goes to show how CBT is very versatile. Now, what about DBT? We talked about dialectical behavior therapy. What is that again? Yeah, for borderline personality disorder, the goal here is it's supposed to target the emotional dysregulation and self-destructive tendencies associated with this disorder. Now, what about motivational interviewing? This one will come up on your board exams for sure. So, when you think motivational interviewing, the immediate thing you need to be thinking about is substance abuse. So, motivational interviewing equals substance abuse. The idea here is that addictions are best treated with competing interests, and motivational interviewing helps uncover what, for lack of a better word, motivates someone to quit when they just don't want to. So basically, what in motivational interviewing, you're trying to find the incentive for someone to quit, and you're just trying to roll from there. Okay, and with that, that finally wraps up this rapid or not so rapid review of psychiatry. It's been really fun to make all these episodes and to help contribute. I wish you all the best of luck in your step studying, your medical journey, and whatever it is you have going on in life. That's really all from me. Thank you for tuning into Spoonful of Sugar. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or if you want to make an episode yourself, please visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org. Good luck with studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help the medicine go down.